February 21st, 2010, is the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Sawat from Pedro show. Sunday here in Pedro. Maybe rain tonight, Brother Matt.
Yeah, a little bit. Sprinkle a little early.
Yeah. Yesterday I went out pedaling early because I thought it was going to come down. But it held off all day. Fireboat 2 was out. And I think it was because of that air raid thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's the biggest fireboat in the world now. It's a tractor. And it was in the marina. I was like, what the fuck is it doing? Usually they got the little number 3 or 5 with the little ladders in the front. Mm. But this was the big mama. Dead. Yeah. And also another dead fucking pelican.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I got a corner of my eye and I wouldn't. It's a heartbreak for me.
Yeah, the bird center's pretty packed.
So, right? Yeah. Dana Point, I have a friend in OC who's been taking care of them. Dana Point, like hundreds.
Why?
They don't know. Oh, yeah, we are a guest here, yeah, Brother Matt. Welcome aboard Flea. Hey. Yeah. But it's a serious thing, this thing with the pelicans.
Yeah, no, what is it?
But they don't exactly know why. A lot of them, the cause of death, starving.
Right.
So they don't know what is up. Also in Portland, where they come down, usually migrate down, the Browns, they're not. They're staying up there.
Right.
They don't understand this behavior. I mean, they really made a bounce back from the 70s. They were really endangered because of the DDT.
Right.
So when they stopped doing that, dumping that in the sea, the shells got hard again. Same with the peregrines and stuff.
All that, like the bacteria is shifting. The chemistry of the ocean is changing, right? Because the ocean is becoming so acidic. It's not alkaline enough. And all the probably the little things they feed on aren't kind of surviving. And
right.
They're starving, right?
Yeah.
That's heartbreaking.
Big problem with the man building living stuff gets rid of wetland.
Right.
And there's no filtering when there's a rain.
Right.
And it runs right off. You know surfing, right?
Yeah.
If you go out after rain and sore throat rock.
Yeah, you don't want to go out after rain in the city.
Yeah, one who got a staph infection had to have a big chunk of his head removed.
Ugh. A surfer guy?
Yeah.
Is that your surfboard sitting outside on the deck there?
The neighbors. Yeah, my aunt is sitting.
Is there surfing around here in Pedro?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Last couple months have been awesome.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a couple of, like, our big Wednesdays, like, every 10 years.
I've seen up in Malibu, when I was living up in Malibu, I used to see dead seals fairly often, or, like, dying seals on the beach.
On the beach?
Yeah, that's real, like,
what
to do.
Yeah, big old things.
Do you know that we got a hospital up where I practice the Angels Gate?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
There's one for mammals, marine mammals, and there's one for birds.
They call them and they come pick them up?
Yeah.
One time up. There was a sea lion on a buoy and had the net around his mouth and just cutting into his flesh. I told the lifeguards. They called up the people. They came down and got him. Yeah, it's... I don't know what people are thinking, you know. And you hear about the honeybees, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know about honeybees?
No, it's kind of
scary.
Big kill.
Really?
They're dropping off. And, you know, parts of the big system start disappearing.
Yeah.
You know about the frogs, right?
No.
Big kill off on frogs. Some of these things like honeybees and tree frogs, very sensitive.
Right.
So it's kind of a little, you know, when they bring the canary down in the mine?
Right.
Right?
Because
you couldn't smell the carbon monoxide, but the canary fell over. Whoa, something's wrong.
Yeah.
This is kind of like this.
Right.
Like, wake up. Something's up.
Yeah.
You're losing your honeybees. You're losing your tree frog, your pelican, your sea lion.
Yeah.
And, you know, meanwhile, we just blindly charge on, you know.
Yeah, man. You know, and you see every time I read stuff about the environment changing and global warming, and the scientists, they've been saying, you know, of course, for years, they've been saying, you know, we've got to stop it with the emissions, and we've got to cut down on fossil fuels and everything. And but now they're saying, well, it's like, yeah, maybe we'll get it, but it's too late. You know, it's irreversible.
Yeah, everything's
the tide's turned too powerfully to be.
And there will be an economic thing, and we'll be lifestyle will be third world. And you hear this claim, you know. I think we need a master a little bit.
Third world, you know.
Thinking about the third world.
The worst thing it ever happened.
I know, because you just went and visited. And, you know, people get by, right?
Yeah, they're dying off.
Right, they might not have the right electronic toys or whatever. But I wonder about quality of life. What's it about? Is it really about material?
I mean, it varies. It's not a black or white thing. But,
yeah.
You know, I just came back. I just got back from Ethiopia. And my time in Ethiopia, the feeling that I left with was that Africa is the future, you know? Being there, being in Ethiopia, and after I went to Nigeria last year too with the same group of people.
So this time east, last time west.
Yeah. And though Nigeria, Ethiopia was a lot mellower than Nigeria. A very friendly place. Everywhere you went, people had, you know, smile on their face. One time I was walking down the street with this guy, this Ethiopian guy, and he's like, "Man, I gotta take a shit." And I just went and knocked on someone's door, some stranger's door, and I used the bathroom. Yes, of course, come right in, you know.
Yeah.
And wow. It's just like that was real indicative of the general vibe there. Like, people are just really helping each other out and really sweet and kind and just great. And the music there, man, music was unbelievable.
I mean, there is some technology, right? People got leashes of cell.
Yeah, they have those. But they have those. I mean, it was in a week, it was really hard to gauge. You know, you see, there's a lot of people that are really poor that have nothing, that are living in huts and stuff. And then there's people, you know, living in big McMansions.
But is there kind of mix where you're in a hut, but you might still have a dish?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like I saw this one guy, like music, I went to see these guys playing traditional Ethiopian music, and this guy's playing this koral, which is like a 5-string instrument. Basically made out of wood and goat skin and the string. I don't know what the string is made out of. But he's playing this traditional music, and then he whipped out his cell phone, and he had a corral. He had a pickup hooked onto it, playing through an amp, and he whipped out the cell phone, sort of playing it with a cell phone and getting feedback and, like, Hendrixing out on this traditional thing, you know, which was amazing.
Kind of mixtures.
So, yeah, but mixtures. But, you know, I didn't, from what I saw, even when I was in, like, rural areas and people were living in huts and stuff, they all seemed healthy and happy. And
yeah.
That was, you know, from what I saw, you know. I mean, I know, like, you know, the famine that was, people always think of Ethiopia, they just think of famine and poverty. And, you know, that famine was going on in the 80s, right?
Like, right, really bad.
In the early 80s, and we're getting all these images of people starving and stuff. And I think that had a lot to do with, because it was a communist country at the time, right? And they really weren't getting any help. You know, especially from the West, you know. But there's no famine there now. I think they have, you know, there's probably some hunger problems in parts of the country. But in general, you know, people seem to be doing pretty well there, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if being third world, you know, whatever that means. I mean, you know.
I just hear this argument, like, if we try to do something with the climate.
Right.
You know, there's a debate, right? And I've heard positions
that we become third world if we stop making the money off the corporate, destroying.
Yeah, we try putting control on greenhouse gases. Oh, that means things are more expensive. You have to be spending money on that. People are losing jobs. I don't know. I hear this kind of thing,
yeah.
I'm thinking. You're kind of saying, like, you don't want to live like a lot of people maybe are in the world. Of course, they would like to live better too, right?
Yeah.
But what is better and worse when you get to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
Is it quality of life, like your health?
Yeah, I just think if your spirit is alive and happy and curious and vibrant, you know, that's really what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like making money as much as the next guy. I mean, look at me, I'm in this big corporate rock band, you know, but it's like, that's not what my identity is wrapped up with in terms of, you know, my happiness. And I know I didn't get any happier when I started making bread than I was when I didn't have bread, but I don't know. You know, I don't know. I think it's always like, it's kind of human nature on the most part for people to always kind of try to amass stuff and get their scene together, you know.
But also think about the future, you know, if they do poison the deal, too bad. Nothing for the grandchildren.
I don't know.
That thing too, because you have kids, so you think about them, right?
I think about it all the time. I mean, my general thought is, fuck the corporations, you know, quit polluting. You know, that's what I always think. But then again, I'm sure I'm hypocritical in a lot of ways too, because I enjoy a lot of the comforts and luxuries that come from the unscrupulous behavior on the behalf of many, you know, global environment destroying things. So,
yeah, like to get down here, you took a car. I drove a car.
I do generally. In my own town. Usually I drive an electric car and I have solar panels at home. But, you know, that's also, like, totally elitist too, because you got to have all this bread to do it.
Oh, yeah. Because they haven't made it econo enough.
Yeah. Not affordable. But yeah. But anyways, but Ethiopia, man, I just, you know, I'm not real.
So how did the trip come about?
Well, it came about.
I should say we started off with John Coltrane playing Underground.
Oh, want to play that first?
No, I already did it.
Oh.
Song of the Underground Railroad from Africa Brass. And then we heard Groovy Seaweed by Waki Ne, which is kind of a Japanese kind of jam band, but they use traditional percussion and all this.
Cool.
And I'm curious how the trip came about.
Yeah, well, I met this guy, Damon Albarn. I don't know if you know who he is. He was a singer in the band Blur in England. Now he has a group, the Gorillaz, like a cartoon hip-hop group. And also The Good, the Bad, and the Queen with Paul Simonon.
You know, oh, the bass player.
Tony Allen, Fela, the great Afro drummer, Tony Allen, Paul Simonon, they made that record, The Good, the Bad, and the Queen.
Fela's land was Nigeria, right?
Yeah, yeah, Lagos. And what happened was last year,
yeah.
I get this email. He started this organization called Africa Express, where the basic concept of it is they get a bunch of musicians together and go to Africa, different countries in Africa, and just cultural exchange. Just hear as much music as possible, jam with as many people as possible, and exchange music.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he was kind of inspired at a certain time. They had when he was growing up, remember they had those Live Aid concerts, and they had one recently. And they had these big Live Aid concerts, and it was all these big, you know, American and European stars, and they're all, like, saying, you know, help Africa and everything.
Yeah.
But for the average African, they're just like, what is this bullshit? Like, they look at this thing, and there's, like, no Africans involved.
Oh, right.
You know, you look at Live Aid, and there's, like, not one African. You know, you got all these big stars, and no Africans. And Damon, he was just like, this is ridiculous, you know? And not that I'm sure that they help some people.
The money's probably some.
I'm sure the money, some of the money, whatever. I don't know the specifics.
I know you can be cynical and say, well, it's kind of self-promoting.
I don't really know. Yeah. I don't know the specifics of it. But
from an outsider, you could look at, or like these cats you're saying in the land.
I do know you could watch this like 3-day-long concert and you wouldn't see one African. You know what I mean? And
it's the cause was
And there's a lot of them. Yeah. There's a lot of good African musicians to choose from. You know? So anyways, he decided, like, that kind of, like, got under his skin. He decided to start this thing, Africa Express. And I got invited last year to go to Nigeria with them. And being a huge, you know, that's where Fela comes from, and the Afrobeat comes from Lagos. And Fela being one of my all-time favorite musicians. And I was also told that Tony Allen was going, who was, like, I think the greatest drummer walking on the planet, you know. And, it was an opportunity to go to Nigeria. And always, like, when I was growing up, it was my dream to play with Fela. Like, I once met this guy who showed up in Lagos, Nigeria, went to the Shrine, which was Fela's club there.
Yeah, yeah.
Knock, knock, knock. I really want to jam and, like, played with Fela's band in Nigeria.
Wow. You met his son?
Yeah, Femi. Well, I met him on this trip.
Oh, okay.
Because
he was playing some festivals last year.
Yeah, he plays guitars. He does his thing, you know, and he's kind of he's Afrobeat too. It's different. You know?
Well, his pop brought him.
Yeah, yeah. He
played on stage at the gates with sax.
Yeah, totally. So, anyways, I went with them to Nigeria, and that was incredible. You know, I mean.
So what it was like gigs with Africans.
Yeah, totally. Well, this time when I went, it was different. The Nigeria trip and the Ethiopia trip were totally different. When I went to Nigeria, you know, Fela had this club called The Shrine, where he played like 5 nights a week or whatever. He constantly played there. It was packed. It was like the social hub of Lagos, you know, and the wickedest music, you know, you ever
heard. Right.
And it burnt down at one point. And there was all kinds of crazy shit happened, you know, there. He lived
he had trouble with the government, I know.
The government, well, they threw him in jail all the time.
His mother.
They killed his mother. They threw her off the roof of his house. Yeah. He had the Kalakuta Republic, which was a, you know, sort of like a
compound
where he lived with all his peeps and everything. And they just, you know, would come in and just beat the hell out of everybody. And, anyways, that's a whole story. But that burned down, and Femi, his son Femi Kuti, rebuilt the shrine, the new shrine. And it's a big place. It holds, I think, the size of the Hollywood Palladium or something. A few thousand people. No, it's just like a big airplane hanging with a stage at one end. It's not like fancy like that or anything. But a great place. And so last time I went, with a bunch of musicians, and everybody, we all like got in a hotel. There's a backyard in the hotel. We all set up amps and drums and just like rehearsed with all these Africans, you know, from different people from Senegal, from Ghana, a lot of Nigerian musicians, and we all just jammed all day long, every day, and worked out a show. And then we went one night and had a big show at the Shrine, which was insane. Without doubt, the craziest show I've ever played in my life. Because a lot of it was just jams, and like everyone kind of sectioned off and formed little groups and did little sets, and I ended up like being a complete jam slut, as you know. I am.
With a bunch of sets.
I just jammed with everybody. Like everyone was asking me, too. Like, every time I turned around, someone was going, just do this. Singing some bass line in my ear, you know. But when we played for them, it was like, when the people liked it, yeah. and the Nigerians liked the music, it was like, yeah, everyone crazy. If they didn't like it, throwing shit at
us.
And pissed off. And playing that square groove. Yeah, like, scary, you know. And... but great, you know, I mean, I met so many, like, super nice people there. Nigeria and Lagos is considered one of the most scary, dangerous cities in the world, you know. And I did have a feeling of being, like, we had, like, a security guy with a gun and everything. And I kind of, like, it felt like a lot of times, like, I'm kind of glad that dude is here, you know, which is a weird thing to say. But, like, and it's also just not knowing where you are, or, you know, you're in the city or at some beach or somewhere and feeling like if I got lost here, I'd really be... fucked. It's not like you're just gonna get a taxi back to the hotel. You know what I mean? It's a sprawling place, man. So anyway, that was Nigeria, and then this year they went to Ethiopia, and so I went again. You should go a lot.
I loved
you. You should go.
Closest I've played in Africa is Tel Aviv.
Right. Africa, man.
You know, it's a whole continent.
And
I haven't played
incredible.
Any gigs.
Incredible. You go there, and it's like another.
Have you played South Africa?
No, never have.
Because there's gigs there.
Yeah. Well, now that I know about the Shrine in Lagos, like when the Chili Peppers get up and running again, you know, we're making a new guitar player and doing all this stuff and everything. We get up going.
Oh, I didn't know. You know, John was on the show.
Yeah, he told me.
When he came out with that Josh Klinghoffer?
Yeah, Josh is our new guitar player.
He's the guy he made the record with. He brought him on over, and they made this solo album, and he wanted to talk about the record.
Yeah, they've been playing together for years.
And,
also, Josh's new guitar player.
Yeah.
He's a nice cat. Young guy.
Yeah, great. Beautiful guy.
We dug him. He played some synthesizer in the jam.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And because before that, he was doing ones with Omar and Joe Lally.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so this was the newer thing I didn't know about, this collaboration.
Well, he and Josh made like 10 records together or something.
They are, yeah. Oh, I know there's a lot of Omar and Joe Lally ones.
Yeah.
Maybe he goes on runs.
He just goes, yeah.
So he left the band.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he just, I mean, you know, of course, you know, like with any decision like that, it's not like one reason.
Yeah. I can't speak about any of that.
I can't speak for him, but I know, like, whatever decisions John makes like that is, I mean, his love for music is so intense. About, like, him nurturing.
And he's still making music, right?
Yeah, always. Yeah,
really passionate. And his buddy's the new guitarist, so...
Yeah.
Did he, like...
Yeah, well,
advise
you know,
him?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, they're great friends, you know, I mean...
What did he say? Suggest, hey, Josh can do it.
We knew, well, Josh was on tour with the Chili Peppers, too. Like, we had a second guitar player for a while. So it was kind of like this guy who was already in the family.
Okay.
Kinda, you know, it's more important for us to, like, play with a bro.
Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, learning from that mistake.
Okay, so when the band gets, you're going to go play the Shrine?
Oh, yeah, so that's what I was saying. It's a great gig in Nigeria, the Shrine, you know? I mean, it's perfect.
Now, what'd you find in Ethiopia? Clubs?
You know, Ethiopia, so in Nigeria, the whole we got there, the whole thing was geared towards this night of the gig. And every night we'd go out to the Shrine, it's like Nigerian hip-hop and all kinds of crazy bands and stuff, and it was great. In Ethiopia, we didn't have a gig. It was just about checking out as much music as possible. So we went to clubs every night in Addis Ababa, which is the capital where we stayed mostly. Then we went to this town called Harar, which is where Rambo went. You know, our tour. Where he
was running guns.
Yeah. Well, he actually, like, the real scoop on that is he didn't really do it.
Oh,
he did.
I talked
to Ethiopians about it, and they're like,
because it was called Abyssinia then.
Yeah. They're like, he lived there for a long time. He loved it. He fell in love with the country.
Right.
You know? But he went to, like, someone asked him to help him supply guns once.
Yeah.
And he did it, like, once and, like, lost all his money, and it was a failure. And it was just, like, one time, one shipment of guns. Really, what he did was coffee.
Coffee.
That was his thing. And he made good bread, like importing, exporting coffee.
The music, because you think of, reggae.
Well, they don't even like reggae in Ethiopia.
That's what I was going to say.
Reggae.
This is what I heard from other people.
And Haile Selassie is big over there, man. They love him.
The Lion.
They love Haile Selassie.
But the reggae guys kind of hooked on to him.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's really no music connect.
There's no connect at all with the music. Okay. There's no kind of reggae in Ethiopia. Oh. And it's funny, like, I mean, I've met lots of, like, Jamaican reggae
guys,
really, they consider Ethiopia like the motherland.
Right,
like
right.
The last place left standing and,
sure.
You know, this Ethiopian thing. And if it's the last place left standing, I'm all for it because it's the greatest place I've ever been. I really felt that. Like, I left that place thinking I just had the greatest time of my life because that place was so uplifting all the time, man. I mean, granted, it's like, you know, when you go someplace that it's so different and exciting, and it's just so different. Like, everything was so new. Like, just driving, we had a bus, you know, and just driving down the street and looking all constantly, I was amazed. But just when you meet people that are, you know, that, like, have so little compared to what we think that we need.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, sure.
And that are so generous and giving and kind, and it's really inspiring.
Yeah, can I take a dump here?
Yeah, exactly, like that.
Or in New York City, I got to plan out my route, you know.
Oh, yeah, totally. There's so many things happen there. Like, we went to this, I met, like, great artists and intellectuals and like, these ladies that sang. I got a CD of them singing. Maybe we could play it.
Let's play some right now.
Yeah, well, this is like, I bought a bunch of different things, but...
Let's play this right now.
When we went to Harar... We met these ladies, these three, like, kind of elderly women, and they sing this kind of traditional Ethiopian music. Just three ladies singing and one playing tambourine. There's a bunch of different, they sang like they'd sing and then stop and sing and then stop, and it's all just on one track. So there's music and it's stop, and some of it's great. I mean, it's all great, but there's little gaps.
It's high quality. Is that the name of the song?
No, that was like one of the guys came, had a real good recording, a mobile recording thing.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Lonnie Hooker, you know? And you
see all these dudes I saw a great Molly in bed last night.
Oh, yeah?
Tenorio.
Here?
Yeah, they played Royce Hall last night. Incredible. And these guys are from the northern part of Mali in the Sahara. They're Bedouin. They're you know, nomadic peoples. Yeah. And they have this band, rock band. They got really into, like, they heard certain rock music. These guys, they went to train to be soldiers. And they heard, somehow, they heard some Hendrix.
Wow.
And they got guitar. Then they went back and, like, made guitars with strings and tin cans and shit. And then ended up getting real guitars and started this band, Tenorio. And since the 70s, they started. And they got the heaviest groove, man. Tenoroan.
Wow.
Check them out. They're amazing. Amazing. Last night, it was mind-blowing.
So they're kind of desert Bedouin, you're saying.
Yeah.
So maybe some Arabic
influence.
Thanks,
Bill. But rock music, though. It's
and mixed with a rock, yeah.
T-I-N-A-R-A-W-E-N. And there's an E in there somewhere. It might be like T-N-R-O-N or something like that. If you Google them, you'll find them.
That sounds bitchin'.
And they're amazing, man. T-N-R-O-N.
And what we heard before was Kuat singers.
Yeah, and this band, I can't remember the name of it, but they're one of the best, like, traditional instrument bands.
But they played in this club, the Fendika Club.
Yeah, they played the Fendika Club.
The Fendika Club?
The club of the guy who was a dancer.
And what was his name again?
Blay
is his last name.
His name wrong.
Not Carla Blay. Not Paul Blay.
His name is...
The legendary poet, guitarist, soul rebels from the Southern Sahara Desert.
Malaku Belay.
Yeah, Malaku, I think.
Malaku. Oh,
yeah,
look,
yeah.
He's got Waste of Space Place.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
M-E-L-A-K-U-F-E-N-D-I-K-A. So that's the name of his club, Fendika.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Malaku Fendika
at
the MySpace place. You can go and check out.
It's worth going to Ethiopia just to go hang out at this club and have a beer and dance, man.
Traditional dance teacher.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah, and he started out by conking out behind the club as a homeless kid.
Yeah.
Through tip money, ends up buying the club.
Yeah.
Yeah, check that out.
Yeah.
And then ends up exporting it with dance, touring.
Yeah, yeah.
Putting on gigs in his own place in Addis Ababa.
Yeah, and great music. And the dancing, like, he really, like, he's a dance teacher, too.
Right,
and these dancers are just amazing.
And the
it's
the shoulder thing. right.
Yeah, the shoulder moves, man.
He gave you a lesson?
Yeah, we had a dance lesson, but it was hard to do the moves. And then when he gave us a dance lesson, also we had, like, some of the main instruments that they use there, which is the choral, the masinko, and, and drums. And then the bass choral, which I tried to get one the last second. I had one and couldn't get it.
Like, is it five strings, too?
It's five strings, and it's like, real wide at the end, and then it has a piece of wood at the end with, like, a goat skin
resonator.
But they pick it up, and it's a great sounding bass. Like, the guy's playing on this, we're going to hear, it's a guy playing a bass choral, a guy playing a regular choral, which is like a guitar kind of five string thing.
Right.
And a guy playing a flute.
Do they have pickups on them?
Yeah, these have pickups on them.
Yeah,
and a masinko, which is a one string instrument. And
what, bow?
With a bow. Yeah, a masinko. And drums. No kick drum, it's just a hand drum.
And they were like the house band.
No, I think they just do a gig there. They play at this place like twice a month or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
and
you
I
can't remember
them.
And
I thought
they
played another place too. And the name of their band, I don't know. But I know that they were slamming.
Yeah.
And
that's what's
good.
Important.
Is that what's playing right now?
I'll go get it now.
Oh, I see.
I just want to fill people
in. Yeah,
they
were real nice guys. And I jammed with them too. Like, we went and jammed with them and kind of ruined their music.
You think?
Well, there were parts that were cool, but also, like, they're. It was difficult.
The time
and to incorporate into their rhythm, you know what I mean? And to them come across, and it kind of got kind of muddy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
there
were good moments. There were great moments.
They probably don't have a lot of experience playing with the...
Different.
The West music.
Yeah, real different rhythms, you know? But they're like, but so friendly and open. And
what kind of amps? What kind of equipment?
They had like a... Man, I don't even know... I don't know.
Was it fancy? Was it econo?
Not fancy at all.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
What about drums? Trap set?
No trap set. Hand drums. And yeah, drums are playing with sticks and with hands.
And microphone.
And he sits up like a trap set on a stool and with a few drums, but there was just no kick drum. You know?
Okay. Tambourine, percussion?
And this band did not have percussion, but oftentimes they would have percussion. Like when we see people just with singers, they would have a percussion.
Okay.
And then we see a lot of little bands where they'd have like a keyboard, like a cheesy electric Casio keyboard. And like a keyboard, and then a bass chorale, or maybe a bass guitar, and a chorale. Maybe a masenko. Yeah. And you start off thinking it's kind of like a cheesy sound, and all of a sudden they start getting down, and it's like, these guys are amazing. You know?
They bring it to whatever they're playing.
Yeah, I got
you
one of those.
Can make that come out of a Casio.
I got one of those, too. I got one of those.
Casio Jam.
Yeah, one of those Casio bands, and they're really good, too.
Yeah. Now, I can imagine, because the human spirit.
Yeah.
No matter what the fucking device.
Yeah, and plus, like when we went to Harare, we saw a band. It was one of those kind of bands, and it wasn't as good. Like, it was kind of like a smaller town. It was like going to see a band, like, in Fresno or something. You know what I mean? Like, they just weren't as hip, you know? But still, they were great. Like, it's, like for me, it was still, if that's all I would have seen, I would have been so happy, because it's, like, just the starting point is so different, and the sense
of
the phrasing is so different. And I was just trying to figure it out all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
What about key stuff? Harmonic, melodic?
Most of it is modal. These simple changes, but the modes are different. You know, real different scales. A lot of microtonal stuff, because on the string instruments, there's no frets, you know. So they have just different scales, a lot of quarter tones. And,
yeah, right.
And,
because I think people, U.S. people, closest connection to Africa are the people who came there, but it was a long time ago. So you're thinking blues music, you're not going to really hear that in Africa.
Yeah,
Because the big space between the
Yeah, I didn't hear anything like that there. I'm sure, you know, there's definitely, you know, exchange.
Well, you were talking about the Mali.
Yeah, Mali, there's a little
There's some tiny little
yeah.
Yeah, well, it's like that band Tanara one that I saw last
that
night.
That had the Hendrix
from Mali. I just floated some, so I'll get some in a spin.
Oh, yeah, cool, yeah, because they're like... you know, they heard blues and Hendrix, and like one thing they really liked was Dire Straits. Somehow they heard Dire Straits, and they really connected with it, and that's like, you know, a big thing for them.
Well, Dire Straits is kind of a blues. Things go around, you know.
People hear stuff, you know.
And
like,
Jimmy had all kinds of blues in his playing. Oh. So Africa comes back to Africa.
No, yeah.
Through all this filter.
Fela. He came to America from Nigeria in the 70s or the late 60s because he wanted to play James Brown, R&B, funk, you know, and he lived in Hollywood and he was you know, getting in on like all like the funk and R&B scene. But then he was like, he realized, I want to go back to Africa, I want to be African. But he bought back this sensibility and created this new African music, the Afrobeat. You know, from getting into...
Jamaica was like that, too. They were listening to R&B guys.
Yeah,
and that was just their take on it.
Yeah, a lot of doo-wop, too. All this vocal
and it just became...
Yeah.
So Africa comes back to Africa.
Yeah, it all comes around, man. Like, I just... I was.
But I would like what you had, the first-hand experience, because I... It's so little we get here.
You gotta go.
Of the real deal, you know what I mean?
I can't even really explain
how
it felt for me there, because it felt... It's hard for me to put it into words, but it was so exciting every moment I was there. I felt so full of emotion, like I was laughing, like tears in my eyes, the whole time, you know. I just felt so full of, like, just the visuals alone, the way people dress, the old buildings, the old streets, just the setup of everything was amazing.
The dress? Any flannels?
No flannels. a lot of, like, those, you know, guys wear those, well, they wear, like, Western clothes, too, but a lot of those... what do you call it? It's like a long shirt that goes all the way down to your feet.
With
you
a magic
dashiki?
Not a dashiki, but a version of that.
Okay.
You know?
Tobe?
I think they call
it. Tobe is like a man's dress or something.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. I can't remember. And women would say lots, you know, headscarves, all pretty colors, purples and oranges and greens. And it's beautiful looking, you know. Everyone carrying stuff on their heads, you know, women carrying stuff on their heads. And one time I went to, we went to this orphan school. Because one of the problem they have in Ethiopia is people who live out in the country send their kids to go to the city, and these families say, we'll take care of your kids. They just have to do a little work. You know, they work like 2 hours a day, whatever, and we'll send them to a good school and take care of them, and they end up making the kids slaves. It's really terrible, you know, and it's a really bad problem. So we met these guys who work with this organization, these Ethiopians, who intercept them. you know, they find out people are doing that to these kids, and they take the kids and take them out of the houses and give them shelter. And we went to a school for these kids, an orphan school. And just a few of us went. Like me and Josh went, and this folk singer, and a few other, Nick from the AIS, and a few other people. And we went and played for them. And it was, man, that was like, I couldn't even, like, those kids were so cool, you know, and I really, like, for me, that was such a poignant moment, right? I stood in a circle, I had a little amp, you know, the amp that I took with me everywhere, and like 300 kids around me, a big circle. I stood in the middle of the circle of my amp and just played bass for them. You know, and they were just going crazy. You know how the I do, like, I'm jumping around, dancing around, soloing, playing grooves, doing my whole flea thing, you know.
Were they doing the shoulders?
Yeah, they were kids, they were laughing a lot. Like, you know, like my kind of rhythms, you know, like American, like funk rhythm and stuff are real strange. You know, I told them before, because I've had experience before, because I went to Haiti a couple of years ago and played for people in Haiti. And they were just kind of like, what the? You know what I mean? Like, their rhythms are so different than my sensibility. And I told them before, I said, look, my rhythms are a lot different. And if you know, you might find them funny, and it's okay if you laugh, because I'm pretty funny anyways, you know. And I played it, and they're in hysterics, but they loved it. Like, they were going crazy. They just thought I was, you know, from the moon or something, you know. But in that moment, like, I really felt like I connected with them, too. Like, it was a beautiful thing for me, you know.
Yeah.
I was playing for those kids, and I really felt like it was really getting to them, you know. Like, it was a great moment. I probably, like,
it was, what do you say, Brother Matt? Transcendent.
It was a transcendent moment. Yeah,
let's play this Fandika band.
Yeah, man. Okay.
Watt for Pedro show. We played
Fendika Band.
The Fendika Band. Sorry, we don't know the name of the band, but did you meet any cats who run labels that are trying to capture this music?
I did.
It's mainly live performed.
I don't know. Well, there's cassettes.
There's cassettes.
It's this funny thing in Ethiopia, though, that I ran into a few times. Is you go to buy something.
Yeah.
You go to a store. Guy selling something. You try to buy. Oh, no. It's like on your shelf. It's a record store. It's a record. Like they do that a lot. Like this bracelet that I'm wearing, actually, that I bought for my girlfriend. It went in there, and the guy said, "I said how much, you know?" And he told me how much money. You know, it doesn't matter what shape. This is gold. It didn't matter what shape it was in, what kind of design was. It's just by the gram. It could be the most intricate design or a clunk of.
It's just the weight of the gold.
The weight of the gold. Because you go in, I go to buy it, and I see the guy tells me how much. Okay, I agree. I take out the amount of money, I put it down. He's like, no. I can't say that. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, he's like, no. And then I had like, you know, a guy I was with, an Ethiopian guy, and he was like, oh, and, like yelled with him for 5 minutes, and I sold it to him. Okay. But it's just like this weird, I don't get it, like what it is. Like, he's not going to sell it. I'm like, no. But why is it for sale? Why are you telling me how much it is? It's some weird cultural
thing. So he'll taunt. Yeah. We're at the end of the first hour. The Watt for Pedro Show, February 21st, 2010. Hold tight, hour two. February 21st, 2010, the second hour of the Watt for Pedro Show.
There's some shoulder moves there. Someone will do some. Hey, this is that band. This is actually the Fendika Club.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess someone will start doing it.
It's the flute?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a guy playing a corral up there.
Yeah. Wow, look at that dress.
Yeah, she looks gorgeous too. Just a little club, you know?
Yeah.
I'll show the move action.
Yeah.
Maybe crazy head banging too. Well, she'll start.
Whoa.
Yep.
That's the bass corral?
I think that's a regular corral. See the bass corral, he's throwing it right there, it's like a box.
Yeah.
There's a dot and uh-huh. strings going out, mm-hmm. like a heart kind of thing, sort of. I always think they're going to stop and then they never stop. You know, they kind of break it down for a minute, then
they need to
figure
it out.
Like this night, they had dancers, so you showed them.
Oh, yeah. That's a weird silk.
Yeah. Some kind of cool getup.
Okay, Hawaii from Pedro Show. Flea's got some footage on the
Ethiopian
phone. Yeah. I wish we could show you people over the radio, but you can't really see. But we're watching them dance and do the shoulder offs and the outfits. And you didn't mention the flute, but the flute was strong.
Yeah, the flute too. Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's also just what's coming out on this little phone.
Yeah. It picks it up better.
It wasn't the most significant instrument.
Serata tranquilla, alcol e solitudine mi facevano girare la testa. Mi avvicinai, contando le monete che avevo nella tasca. Odore di zolfo, sudore e caffè sotto la fermata del bus. Una vecchia, lontana, affacciata a una finestra, mi guardava con disapprovazione. Mi rimisi a contare le monete, questa volta nel palmo della mano, per mostrarle il mio di disprezzo. Con tutto il degrado che la circondava, mi domandai perché. Perché avesse proprio da ridire sulla mia di moralità? Mi assicai qualcosa che somigliasse a un insulto, attirando però l'attenzione del motivo per cui ero in quel posto. Le chiesi il suo nome, mi portò alla mente il mio viaggio a Praga. Esauritasi la transazione, optavo per il retro di una siepe. We'll be right back.
We started out, I played some music from Italy. You know, I was in Italy Fleet.
Oh, cool.
In November and December.
Yeah, I think you were doing a recording there.
That's right, with some musicians there.
What part of Italy?
And, let's see, it was, a lot of it was in Bologna, is where we practiced up, but went and recorded up in the north. Played Bologna, Padua, Roma, Torino, Cesena, and Firenze. I ate a lot of good stuff. And I mean, it's a weird kind of trip, but because we were discussing the history with Ethiopia, and it was very bad. But the cats I was playing with, they wouldn't be in on that old history. They would have probably loved it too.
Yeah.
And it was really great to play with them. And let's see some of the bands. Sigodi, yeah. These cats, I did a show. Of course, it's in the kitchen. I mean, the guys in the band are cooking.
Yeah.
They had pasta so much up in the thing. And while we're doing the show, they're cooking. And we're shouting. You can hear it. And Sigodi with This is Simplified Response. And they had some stories touring in the Balkans during the war and stuff. The guys just thought, hey, if I put on a gig, it was in Macedonia, if I put on a gig during the war, maybe people would like say, hey, no to the war.
Right.
And let's get into music.
Right.
So balls out in the, and they came to the border, guys stuck a bazooka in the window. And they wanted some heavy metal cassette CDs.
Right.
They didn't have any, but okay, you can go.
Dedicate a song to you.
So if you're traveling, maybe border guards all over the world, you know, kind of unite under heavy metal. So maybe you want to, like, sling some, just for some insurance, you know. What a trippy thing. And they went and they did the gig, and the Sigodi. And then La Via degli Astronauti. These are some young guys in Napoli, and really young. Yeah, a lot of, I remember first playing in Italy in the early 80s. And a much different scene. It's come around. I wanted to ask you about, because the people in the bands here in Ethiopia are not really young people, right?
These were young people.
Teenagers?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're not teenagers.
Because I've noticed.
You know, it's like early 20s, you know?
I've noticed about young people in a lot of the lands I've been to.
Yeah.
They all are in touch with, like, you know, like skateboarding. There's some like kind of things that are like.
Yeah, I didn't see any skateboarders.
No skateboarders?
I saw a basketball court.
Okay. Yeah, okay, but like.
But soccer is.
But no punk bands.
No, not.
No Ethiopian.
I doubt there's ever been one. You know, I at one point I went to go see. I was shopping all these English guys, you know.
Yeah.
And there was an English football game on it they really wanted to see. It was like Chelsea
soccer.
And. Soccer. I can't remember. Something was Chelsea and somebody. And they're all excited about it, and we got this town hurrah, and I found out that it's playing in this hotel. The game is playing. So we go to this hotel, and in the lobby, there's like 100 chairs. And the game playing on, like, you know, a very modest television, you know. But like 100 people all, you know, in the fold-up chairs sitting there. And everyone is like, you know, has a drink. And everyone's like real calm and composed. Like, you know, you go to games, and everyone's like, ah!
Yeah,
screaming, you know. And everyone was real cool and like clapping for a good play or not. But like everyone was so like mellow and polite about it, but really into the game, like focused on
the
strategy of the game unfolding. And that was pretty cool.
Just a different take, not the
hooligans. I guess also because it was, you know, it was English football. It wasn't African.
And then we heard H.A. Prague by Squartet. There's a thing over there called Jazzcore. Have you heard of that scene? It's kind of like, remember Gone? Greg had that band Gone? It's a little bit like that. Instrumental music.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, maybe some King Crimson.
Yeah, yeah. Gone was like, then became the Rollins band.
Right? That's right.
Andrew and Sim. And
that's right. He took those musicians.
Yeah.
That was a weird trip.
Yeah.
But they have a thing over there. Incredible. This guy, what's his name? Manlio. He plays guitar without a strap.
Hmm.
He puts his foot up on the chair, you know. He don't wear a strap.
Right.
Fuck it. This guy can jam like a motherfucker.
Wow.
He ain't really, he's in Roma, but if you say that, I'm from Terracina, you know, he's from a smaller town on the coast, and he's very proud of it. Man, can this cat rip.
Wow.
you know, on a trippy scale. And usually they're trios and the bass player doing kind of funk.
Yeah.
Drummer Cobham kind of stuff. It's trip, you know? Yeah. But it's got a vibe of a punk thing.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. And that's Squartet. Do you know Zoo? They're another Roma band, but they use a bass, drum, and saxophone. Mm. Another instrumental thing that you might dig on. And then we heard...
What is the jazz core? Like, what is the kind of music like?
Well, I was kind of explaining it there. It's instrumental. It's very, like, technical, but it's got a vibe that's kind of wild.
Right.
You know,
like, so we call it instrumental, like, but is it like a lot of chord changes and odd time?
A lot of riffs and a lot of switching around in time and stuff. And we can call it fusion, like, because it's very intense and emotional.
Right. Yeah.
But
it's always good fusion.
But the skills.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's something about fusion that's more. Maybe it's got some closeness to it.
I feel like fusion gets a bad rap.
Well, some fusion. Maybe I'm talking about
some everything. You know what I mean? Cartoon version. I mean, like Mahavishnu Orchestra. Like, I love them.
This is kind of close to that. Did you ever see them?
I never saw
them. I got to see them in Long Beach. It was the Birds of Fire.
Wow, you saw that?
Yeah, I saw it. That was intense.
I bet.
And yeah, in a way, it was kind of rock and roll.
Right.
You know, I know. When I'm thinking fusion, I'm thinking more of the Return Forever.
Right.
Is that different than Mahavishnu?
Yeah, a lot different.
I mean, I think there's a reason why there's more than one band, probably.
Right, yeah.
the idea of genre is pretty fucked up, ain't it?
Yeah.
It's almost a marketing man's idea.
Yeah.
So, say fusion. It's why I'm scared to say that word, because all of a sudden it puts in people's minds, right?
It comes up as being like this, like, jack-off music, like musicians showing off without any real emotion or passion or trying to communicate anything outside of their amazing skills, you know? Okay. And I feel like it's an unfair rap, because you get that in all music, you know?
I think the word kind of came from, because isn't Bitches Brew the first?
Yeah. It's funny, it comes from, when it's good, it's jazz guys going into the rock world. When you get rock guys going into the jazz and going fusion that way, it usually doesn't end up being as good. You
okay.
Know? That's what
because
I think.
There's a Mingus song called Cumbia Jazz Fusion.
Really?
Yeah.
The record.
And it's very old. It's like from the early, not very old, but from early 60s.
Right.
He dates the rock thing.
Right.
But I think he was thinking maybe fusion with the... Cuban beats, this kind of stuff. Because Diz got into that.
Yeah.
And somehow getting the U.S.
Right.
version of black music in with maybe rootsier black musics. The fusion just means putting things together.
Yeah.
But when we hear that now, right, it just puts pictures in your mind.
Yeah. So. Little fake plastic palm trees on the
glasses. Palm trees on the face. And then we heard Hank by the Space Pony. And then one of the two of the musicians I played with, Andrea Belfi, and he has a band called Rosalina Mar, and they made a piece for, they got a little kid singing, like Canzone della Tre Vita, which is like a song for three lives. And then Stefano Paglia was the guitarist, and he did this India thing, part of his last days. These guys, both these guys came from more, like, they're 20 years younger.
Right.
I like that. It's a trip. They come from avant-garde, so more like the dronings.
Right.
Kind of thing. Opposite of loud notes, like Mario and Square Tip. Ambient.
Right.
Interesting takes. For me, I'm kind of... I think everybody's got something to teach me. I'm all ears. And I want to go to Ethiopia. But that was a great experience for me. But the record's going to be mixed in 3 weeks, other than that. Yeah. So this thing now I'm trying to do where you just go somewhere and go do it.
Yeah.
Just make a record, play with these guys, learn from them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not where you're from. It's where you're at. And because they're big life lessons. Maybe it took me to get to middle age to appreciate this. But I'm into that. So I want to play some more music from your Ethiopia trip for you, and then we're going to do the spin cycle. So let's.
Oh,
and the spin cycle is going to have Flea collaborate with
you.
Okay. So here's something from a police trip.
I'm And it's time for the I edition with Brother Max. Yeah.
People, that was Brother Matt in a Spin Cycle collaborating with Flea on bass. And, yeah, some foul up somewhere. We only got like 2 minutes and 40 seconds of like a half hour jam. Oh, man, I don't know. Call it a radio clam, but... yeah, Mike Watt taking responsibility for that one. I don't know what happened. But to finish up the rest of the second hour, I'm going to play some stuff from Flea's trip from the Fendika Club. Fendika, F-E-N-D-I-K-A. Fendika Club House Band. I don't know the name of the song or the name of the band or anything, and but Flea was there and got to witness this, captured it on a machine, so we'll share it here. Again, my apologies. That was some smoking bass. Yeah. Damn.
Oh, with a delicious
Thank you. Destiny can act at you. Come to Jennifer. Gay to Gambad. Let you shoot the Yoko.
Stuff. Righteous. Thank you, Flea, for bringing that from Ethiopia. Share with us. Again, people, I apologize for being such a shitty pewter operator. Coming, dealing with running a radio show, capturing, are failing to capture Brother Matt and Spin Cycle, collaborate with Flea on bass all but 2 minutes and 40 something seconds. But we heard the Fendika Club house band there. And yeah, February 21st, 2010, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour three. Sorry again, Flea, Brother Matt, all you folks.
Cool spot, like just five blocks over. There was like a little hidden place. But it had too many leaks. That was the ceiling, that colorful picture on top. That was the ceiling because they didn't have enough pots and pans anymore. It leaked so bad. So.
It's February 21st, 2010. Third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
Thank you.
Show. Start off the third hour with Cerebral Crazy, that's a good Priyatya Sa Mastom by Disciplina Kishman, that's telling the fleet.
Dobro.
Yeah. Coach is quite a bass player. This guy is wild, and I had the honor of meeting him when I was last in Belgrade last summer. Or summer before now.
Time's flying.
And long history, big culture there. This was the version of the band he had with the Croatian guys on the horns and him on bass and another Serb guy on drums. And they actually tried to go to England because, you know, it got kind of heavy, right, the war. And, man, they got hosed out. You're not going to do gigs.
Oh, man.
It was fucked. So a few years of that, he went back to Serbia. You know, the war was over. So, music is just such a great thing. And then the other of these so-called important issues, fucking bullshit, gets in the way always. And then we heard a band from England called Beard and a song called Bloated, and that's trippy stuff. And from Japan, Boris. You know Boris?
I've heard of Boris, but I don't really know Boris.
And Furry. Fleet? We're kind of going backwards because we started the show off with you talking about something that just happened last week, but I'd like you to talk about your journey in music and how it started.
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that because I've been thinking about that lately and talking to people about it. Not so much about my particular journey, which I'm very ready to talk about, but I have this music school, Silver Lake Conservatory of Music, I started with some friends in Silver Lake, and a lot of times we get calls up at the school. We'll get, we have like 700 kids in there now. So,
wow.
But we get a lot of calls from people, and they say, like, my grandson, he's really showing an aptitude to music, and, we think he should take lessons. Like, great. But it's kind of, I feel like I always want to say, every kid has an aptitude for music. I don't believe, it's just like, you could be born into it. It's just like, I just happened to, when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, my mom divorced my dad and remarried a guy who was a jazz musician. Because she started, she hooked up with this guy. And he's a jazz musician, so all of a sudden there was music around me all the time. I went from a real square house. My real dad worked for the government, the Australian government. And it was a real square, no music, no art. It was like, he went to work every day with a briefcase, came home, he had dinner, It was real cut and dry,
So it's a contrast.
And so, so my mom remarries this guy, this new, and he's a jazz musician. And all of a sudden there's like jams at the house. And I come home from school, and these guys are there, like, playing Charlie Parker songs, saxophones and drums and basses and jazz going on. And the upright bass, going for it. He's a bass player. And it blew my mind. I was like, holy cow. I mean, it was literally, like, if you would right now, like, turn into a mouse, you know what I mean? Or some magical, be invisible or something, that would be no more magical than what that seemed to me when I heard that when I was a kid. Like, these guys just blowing and sucking and hitting on these things and making this music.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that they could do it. And I was like, well, I'll give this a whirl. And I started playing trumpet when I was a kid and wanted to be a jazz trumpet player. But I'll go on with that. My point is being, I just happened to be around and be exposed to it and be in a situation where I could nurture something that was amazing, clearly amazing to anybody. What I mean?
Right.
And because I remember one other experience when I was a kid, much younger. When I was living in New York, I was like 6 years old or something.
Yeah.
I was walking down the street, and in the alley behind my house, there were these kids, and they all had like trash can lids and brooms and all this stuff, but they had a hidden radio somewhere playing music, like rock music. And they were playing it.
Miming it.
But I thought they were really doing it. And I was like, what's the trick? What's the fucking trick? How do you do it? Because I thought they were really making the music. They had the hidden radio. And they were tricking me, and they were succeeding, And so, but then when I saw these guys actually doing it, it was kind of the next step. Like, hold on. Because then I was really making a connection between the blowing on the saxophone, the sound coming out, the hitting the drum, the different sounds, toms and cymbals. And the fact that they all had this language where they could communicate. And there was no, like, they weren't reading music, they weren't, had no plan, they were just playing jazz, And so that was so exciting for me, and then my stepdad, he said, well, what instrument do you want to play? And I said, well, I like Louis Armstrong, I like to play the trumpet.
Okay.
And so I started playing trumpet.
It was Louis Armstrong?
it was Louis Armstrong, yeah, was it really blew my mind, you know. And I started playing trumpet and started, you know, for a little kid, I was doing pretty good and playing in the school band. I played and went to the L.A. public schools.
Right.
I played at Bancroft Junior High School. I played at Fairfax High School. Right. You know, I played in the band, the orchestra, the jazz band, the musical production band, the marching band. But the Fairfax High marching band, you know, we didn't have... We were the only school of all the football games. We had no uniforms. You know, all of the schools had big hats and the epaulets. Sure. We didn't have the funding.
Ours are black and gold, right?
We're yeah, well, we just had a T-shirt that said Fairfax Band. And we also, just like, we had no moves. We walked out into a clump in the center of the field and rocked some jumps. But we were pretty good, though. Like, musically, I thought we were pretty good. We played a lot of, like, we had, like, Stevie Wonder songs. We had a good band leader, you know, who arranged the stuff for us. And,
I'd rather have good music than good uniforms.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. I loved it. You know, I must admit there was a lot of pot smoking going on, you know, that time. I played in the school music, and I just wanted to be a jazz trumpet player, you know, because I was brought up on the jazz. And also, by my stepdad, it was kind of that elitist jazz thing where, you know, he frowned upon rock music and pop music and stuff. Okay. Big time. You know, it was
like some technique.
Yeah, get some technique, and that music is all about haircuts and making money, and, you know, there's a point.
Band uniforms.
Yeah, you know, it's a point, you know.
Yeah, I know, totally.
You know, even though, you know, as you know, I learned there, you know, when I discovered punk rock, I found out, to me, that, you know, there was as much validity in one out-of-tune chord as a Coltrane solo, you know, the intention. Yeah, the intention from which it's played, you know.
The emotion, the heart.
The motivation.
That's hard. That's something I think you have to just learn.
Yeah, you really do.
I can tell you. You have to learn.
The germs were the thing for me, you know, that really...
Yeah.
But that's kind of getting ahead of myself. So I played in the high school band, and then around that time I met Hillel, who was my friend. Like, I was just running down the street one day. Me and Anthony, we were, like, best friends and, like, real troublemakers and stuff. And we were running down the street one day hitchhiking, and we saw Hillel drive by at a car. Like, we were just 16. He was, like, the only one who had a car. And we saw him. We didn't really kind of knew him from school. Didn't really know him. But we were like, we know that dude. Hey! And he gave us a ride. And then we started becoming friends, and he was playing guitar and playing in a rock band called Anthem in our high school. And it was kind of like prog metal-y kind of... I don't know, they liked Rush and stuff like that, you know, and Queen and, you know, Zeppelin and after we became friends, he had this rock band. And he said, well, he wasn't digging the bass player, and he said, why don't you learn to play the bass, you know? And I was like, okay. And 2 weeks later, I was on stage at Gazzari's Battle of the Bands,
playing bass.
Playing bass.
All the time was trumpet.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
well,
literally 2 weeks after.
You always had the bass since you were 8 in your life.
But the upright and is yeah.
It's much different.
Much different instrument, you know. So, and then I was, next thing you know,
did
2 weeks.
Did you ever grab your stepdad's bass?
I think I might have. It was kind of off limits, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
a good one, huh?
Yeah, I think he had a good one. And it was just kind of, you know, our relationship was kind of antagonistic, you know. He was kind of wild.
He wanted you to play trumpet.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, he was supportive. It was just, you know, I was a teenage kid and out of control. And
he ain't touching the bass.
Yeah, don't touch the bass. Don't touch the records. Don't touch the bass. Don't touch.
Oh, he must have had some cool records.
Great jazz records, you know. And I was lucky because of him. I was raised around so much great music.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So much great jazz. So much just you know.
And it all added up to Gazzari's.
Yeah, it ended up with me on Gazzari's. After playing bass for 2 weeks, I met Hillel, and I was down, just kind of knowing the frets, you know.
Yeah.
And then I just got into being in a rock band, you know, and at a certain point we changed our name to What Is This, and we started playing, graduated high school, and started playing club.
Alan,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, now he was Alan Mashulski, and he was in, you know, Anthem.
That's
too.
Right.
It was him and Jack. Yeah, it was Alan, Hillel, Jack Irons. You know, Jack Hillel and Jack both ended up starting with Chili Peppers. But so we just played all the clubs around, you know, Madame Wong's, Hong Kong Cafe, you know, El Señorial Club, the Vex.
That was the connection.
Everywhere we could play.
Oh, but the difference is Anthony.
Yeah, yeah. And then Anthony used to introduce us. He was our friend. Anthony wanted to be an actor. and he never had any aspirations to be a musician or in a band at all. And then we had our band and we would play around and we did okay. We were happy, you know. But we weren't really.
You were digging the bass.
Loving the bass. I had a lot
after
of fun playing.
After a while,
Right away. And away.
And then let go of the trumpet.
I kind of let go of it at that time. I mean, I still played it, but I became a bass player in a rock band. That became my thing, you know. And I just wanted to be as good as I could be, you know.
Yeah.
But I was so, you know, we came up in such a drug culture, you know, and we were pretty kind of out of control in that way, you know. But just loved music. Like, and I think, like, all the way through, music has just been my savior, you know. Like when I was a kid, you know, my stepdad, he had a real bad drug problem and stuff, and my house was very a volatile place, you know, and I was basically, like, when I was like 12, 13 years old, I was out in the street till like 4 in the morning, you know, I was just gone.
Didn't want to be home.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, that's just how it went.
So music gave you good focus.
But music gave me, in school.
Lifeline.
In school, it was like, you know, I loved playing in the marching band and playing in the band and all that stuff. And it gave me a reason to go to school.
Right,
gave me something to do. It was like I practiced, I liked my instrument, I liked playing, I aspired to be good.
Were you writing songs?
Not really. No, not really.
But it still was kind of a form of expression.
It was a big form of expression. And it was just like a social world, and it was a discipline. Right. It was something to believe in.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It gave me hope to do something, you know. And then when I started playing bass and being in a rock band, then there was the whole, you know, rock band fantasy, you know.
Did you go to rock gigs?
Yeah.
In that house.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, well, not until just like at the end of high school.
Okay.
Like me and Anthony started going. We'd go up to Starwood all the time, you know, Starwood and Troubadour.
So you didn't really do the arena rock?
No. I didn't. Well, the first rock show I ever saw was arena rock.
Okay.
It was the first rock show I ever saw. I went to UCLA and I saw UFO. With Pat Travers Band and Blue Oyster Cult. That was the first one
ever.
That
would kind of qualify.
Yeah. That was just like I had some goofy friends who were in
the pavilion.
Yeah. I had some goofy friends who were into rock music and they took me, you know. But I wasn't.
That way.
And I was like, I was kind of cool, but
who
I was kind of.
You know what I saw there? It was Bob Marley.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing. That's my favorite Poly Pavilion.
Wow.
But the whole idea of being so far away.
Yeah.
The club was so much different, huh? When you and Anthony started going.
We started going. I'd see bands. And that was when I started playing bass in a band, was when I started going.
You could identify.
Yeah. And initially, I was scared of punk rock, you know. Like, I heard music that I liked, but I went to go, like,
was
I went
some guys at school with the first ones?
There were some, like, Tracy Marshak, who was in Red Cross. She went to Fairfax High.
Were they kind of the scary people?
And
like,
no. There were very few at Fairfax High.
Yeah,
I graduated class of 80. There was Tracy Marshak. There was, like, a couple. And everyone made fun of her. And I know for sure I thought she was cool, you know. I thought, like, she... Because I was outcast anyway. Everyone called me fag. I had no friends. Yeah, I was a real outcast. And I just thought, she's bold, you know. I thought she was cool. But the first punk rock show, I went to go see Black Flag at the Starwood, and it was so violent, man. I mean, literally, it was like ambulance just rolling people away. Like, I just saw, like, guys, like 10 guys stomping someone's face in, and all night long, over and over, and it really sickened me. Like, I hated it. I was like, these people are fucking idiots. I don't want to have anything to do with it. And I really didn't. I was like, anything that, like, beats people up because of their haircut is not for me. You know what I mean? It was like right in, it was like, I love music, you know, and I was open to the music, but the violence just bummed me out. And it was a little while after that what kind of happened to me in, like, getting into punk rock is I was not getting along with the What Is This Guy so well. And I went to, one night I took acid and I went to the Club Lingerie and I saw Fear play. And I thought it was amazing, you know, like just like the dance of the fast hands and the bum 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 bum. Yeah, and it wasn't, and I was just on acid and I was just like checking out the music and getting really into it.
Oh no, their stuff was like Beethoven in a weird way.
And they were like good musicians like Spit and Philo and stuff.
The thing they threw in their songs was
intense. Yeah, and for me, like liking like all that like prog rock and stuff and Hendrix, like I was real attracted to being to like the virtuoso thing of rock music.
Yeah, sure.
And I saw them and they were real good players and I was like on acid. And anyways, I was loved it. The next day I was like, I saw this band, they were great. And even though I had seen punk rock bands, I really liked, 'cause I saw X, I really loved X.
But the next, like, literally, I saw Fear, like, 3 days later, I see an ad in the paper. Fear looking for a new bass player. I was like, hello? And I went down there and they hired me.
Because you probably saw Durf scratch.
Yeah, I saw with Durf, yeah.
Probably the last gig.
One of the last, I'm sure, because, yeah, the next week. In the LA Weekly, it said, wants a new bass player, and I went down there and they hired me, you know. And
my first Fender P bass I bought from Durf Scratch.
Right, okay.
He was selling real estate or something in Santa Monica.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It was an ad to recycler. I didn't know.
Right.
You know, and
wow.
I saw him playing, and I thought, I know where I got that.
I thought Durf was great.
Yeah.
I thought they were a great band. Like, that Fear the Record, I think, is a great record, mm-hmm. you know.
Recorded kind of funny, but I know them songs from the gigs, and they just right. slayed me.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, that band.
Yeah.
Right, so they're kind of classical music right. in a strange way.
Yeah.
Not so much rock and roll backbeat, it was like this kind of...
Yeah, well, like, really like, cool, like, dissonant chord movement and stuff. And,
yeah, yeah.
And, you know...
Very dramatic.
Yeah, and Lee was really a little charismatic, you know.
Yeah. So you joined the band.
And so I joined the band, and that just opened up... And that was, it was kind of weird, too, because they were a lot older than me.
Yeah.
I was, like, 18 or 19, and they were all in their 30s, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I joined a band, and I was real into it. But the thing that kind of happened was, I remember one night I was, like, out with them at some party, and I heard the Germs. And I was like, what is that? Like, it really...
Were they playing? Or
No. I never saw them play. I tried to see them once play at the last show at the Starwood.
Wow.
And I couldn't get in. You know, me and Anthony used to go there and get into Starwood, but I couldn't get in. But anyways, I heard that, and I was like, and they were putting it down. They're like, oh, they don't know how to play, you know. And I wanted to be cool, like, with them. They were like my new bros. I was like, oh, yeah, they were good. But then what happened, then, like, the week after, this all happened so quick. And then, like, a week after that, I went to Lee's house for dinner, and I met Penelope Spheris was there. And she asked me to be in her movie, Suburbia. She was making this movie about, like, punk rock kids living in a squat. And she said, it'd be in a movie, and I was like, a movie? Whoa, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, great, I'll be in it. And then from then, when I met her, then I met all these, like, punk rock kids who were all into, like, all the different hardcore punk rock bands and stuff. And that's what really, like, and I made friends with all these kids, and they turned me on to all this music. That's when I found out about the Minutemen, you know. That's when I found out about, like, all the local bands, you know. And that was really cool, like, all the underground bands. And I just like going down, like, the Brave Dog and Al's Bar and... Like, I was more attracted mostly to the, like, kind of arty bands, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it was just a whole new world. And I go to the Café de Grand all the time, all the Hollywood punk rock clubs. And it was kind of like the first time in my life, really, that I felt like I belonged to something, you know? Like, I could go out to these clubs every night and there'd be all these kids. And I was always, like, all my life, I was a real loner before that, you know, really. Like, I was just always to myself and... And or I'd have like one friend, or you know. But when I all of a sudden I felt like I belonged as like a community of people, and it was really, I really liked that a lot. And then right around that time, and that was going on, like, real into it, like 81, 82, Anthony went and saw Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. They came out, you know, they had that big hit, The Message, and sure. they played, and he went to see him, and he came back and he was like, I'm gonna be a rapper, because he knew he wanted to be a rapper, but he couldn't sing, but I'm gonna be a rapper, you know. And
also, you go back to the other guys.
Yeah. And so, and then you know, and at that point, they kind of forgive me for leaving him and joining Fear, and then
you left Fear.
Yeah. Well, not I first me. No, I was still
but
in
you
Fear.
Both.
I was still in Fear, and then Anthony wanted to be a rapper, and so we started with Chili Peppers, and he was like, okay, well, you rap, and we'll play funk groups.
Yeah, right. But you're doing both bands.
Yeah. I'm doing both, and then. And also, like, then Fear started going in this real kind of metal direction, like wanting to play like hard rock metal, and I really wasn't into it. I just wasn't feeling it at all. And I remember, like, sitting there, like, trying to build up the nerve to call up Lee and quit, because I was really, like, the Chili Peppers, all of a sudden, I really felt home, like, the first time. And we were just going around playing clubs, and I'm literally, I swear to God, I'm sitting by the phone going, okay, I got to call him. I'm just going to call him. I'm going to tell him. I wasn't scared of him. You know, I was intimidated by him. You know? Yeah, and I was, you know, I was older. And sure. And it was real nice to me, like, kind of took him into his wing. It was almost like a father figure kind of, you know? And I'm sitting there trying to build up the nerve to call him, and the phone rings and it's him firing me. for being in the Chili Peppers and all that. And,
wow.
And it was like, I was so happy. I was so happy. I'm off the hook. Oh, okay. He was like, well, this is hard to say. And I was like, okay, yep, okay, see ya. I was so happy, you know. And then I just went for the Chili Peppers, you know. And when I started the band, or when we started the band,
that's when you start writing songs.
Yeah. Really. Like, I tried a little bit with Fear, but it wasn't until the Chili Peppers where I started.
Right.
And I had no designs, and as you know, like, in that time, at least in my world, I had no plans to ever make money or anything like that. We just wanted to do something that was unique and cool, and go out and play clubs. They'd let us play. You know, we got to open for the Bad Brains. We got to open for the Minutemen.
Yeah.
Gang of Four was one of the best gigs ever.
Yeah, I saw Gang of Four. Huge influence. That was before. That was a real big influence on us, Gang of Four. We saw them play. And
saw us play at the Cuckoo's Nest.
Wow, Gang of Four.
D. Boone, there was like 9 people.
Wow.
And they gave it.
Yeah,
you know,
man.
Some people, there's not enough.
They don't
play hard.
Yeah.
They went for it.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And it was trippy how big they put the bass in the band.
Yeah, yeah, and great bass lines. And just
you know,
real
for us, we knew of this other England band called the Paku. Remind us of that.
Yeah.
But we never got to see the Paku.
Yeah.
They never played here. But we did see those guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
They didn't care, man. They went for it.
Yeah, cool.
You know?
No, that must have been in their first record, I guess, right?
It was.
Yeah. Yeah, well, now I feel like it's like people start bands, and it's like the way the world is now. They start bands like, let's get a lawyer and an agent and a, you know, this and a that and be famous, you know. And I like, back then it was just like, I wanted to make, my dream was just to not have to have a job, because I always had full-time jobs this whole time, too. You know, I worked in an animal hospital, I worked at a liquor store, I worked photographer's assistant, whatever job I could get. And not fancy photographers, just like for the school yearbook pictures, you know. So it was just, you know, and I mean,
you wanted to make music your job.
Yeah, I wanted to make music my job, and it got like the Chili Peppers, you know, it happened pretty quickly. You know, we started making enough money, like to I could pay rent. You know, I could pay rent and eat, and it was amazing. You know, and
you know, Hill House has played bass.
Yeah.
Did you like check out other? Did you like investigate when you were listening to the records why you were on the trumpet?
Was it being had? I've been thinking about bass before,
or when
not really.
Now it comes to you.
Yeah.
Now it's in your hands. Hey.
Well, then
that guy might have been doing something interesting there. Was there any guys?
Yeah. Well,
records, I'm thinking.
You know,
early on.
Well, I was real big on Led Zeppelin.
So you like,
I was real
Paul
big
Jones.
On Led Zeppelin. I love John Paul Jones. I still do. Yeah. And like, there's one thing, like when I got in like the punk rock scene and stuff, and all these bands you weren't supposed to like.
Yeah.
I never bowed to that. I was like, fuck that. I love Zeppelin. I never towed the punk rock line. I was never cool like that. I couldn't not like something I liked. You know, like it's always been that way with me. Like I never, like everything that I've ever liked, I still like. Nothing has ever gone away.
The Peppers used to do some cool Led Zeppelin sets, huh?
What's that?
I saw you guys do a couple of cool Led Zeppelin sets back in the day. That was great.
Yeah, you know. Yeah,
cool sets of Led Zeppelin?
I don't know about that.
A few songs in a row.
Yeah, I guess so. I can't, probably. I can't remember Chili Peppers ever doing a Zeppelin cover, but probably just jamming around.
Yeah, it was. You guys were just, it was like at the end of the show, just having fun, I think, when the socks were on.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, a big thing for us, too, like, always from the beginning, even like in What Is This, was improvising. You know, it was such a big part of our thing. Like we didn't even play. We improvised and just jammed more than we played songs. You know, and that we didn't really. I don't think that like we really understood the songwriting thing that well.
Ah,
you know what I mean? Like
sure.
Like, and even with the Chili Peppers, it was, you know, just grooves.
Yeah.
You know, and Anthony would make up raps over the grooves.
Right.
I mean, you saw us early on. It was
just.
You know, we just wanted to make grooves that we thought were real unique and wild, you know. And
but that was big with bass.
No, yeah. Well, it was great for
so
bass.
So you must have been listening. Did all those lines come to you, or were you listening to Anthony Turgeon to some record?
Yeah, we all just listened to
I think that
everything.
Was Sugar Hill.
People. Yeah, Sugar Hill.
So maybe Doug Wimbish.
Yeah, that we used to listen to that. Yeah, Doug Wimbish, and you know, I was real big on Jaco Pastorius, you know, and I didn't get into really get into like I knew the popular P-Funk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was high school, I liked P-Funk. Like I knew like you know Mothership and One Nation Under a Groove and stuff. And it wasn't until the Chili Peppers were like well going and stuff until I really discovered the Funkadelic and all that,
okay.
All that you know.
Billy Bass.
Yeah, Billy Bass, awesome. I saw him play a couple of years ago, and he's just incredible. That guy.
He started young in that band too.
Yeah, they were real young. First Funkadelic record, they're in high school, man. Yeah, and that's amazing, you know. You know, Bernie Worrell was like, you know, they're great musicians.
Yeah.
And
rocking. You know,
hard.
When this is a weird kind of line. I mean, for bass players, it's ridiculous for people to say, you know, that funk music isn't rock music.
Oh yeah.
Never got all like torn away. Maybe because the guitar got elevated.
Yeah. Never for me. You know.
Me either.
Like I always, the funk has always been such a big part of my listening.
With real rockin' stuff, the bass is strong, I still think.
Oh, yeah, man.
I know I got... Maybe you could hear it better at the arenas.
Yeah.
There's something about being a support... quote, support guy.
Yeah.
You know, rock is really rhythmic music, so you need support.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean... You know, I mean...
They did it to drummers, too, though.
Yeah, I always felt like... Like, you know, when I started playing a bass, I definitely wanted... Like, when I would see rock bands when I was in high school, I remember thinking, well, if I ever play in a rock band, I'm going fucking crazy. You know? Like, I am not, like, I just, like, it seems like, because I was just, like, the whole thing seems like the most exciting part, so when guys go crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go crazy the whole time, and that was my plan, you know? And when I got in one, it was just, you know. I you know, it's just what made sense to me, you know?
When you guys were playing the clubs and stuff,
yeah.
You're playing with bands, you're seeing the guys play.
Yeah.
Cats.
Yeah, guys, I love
rock. Record, huh?
Yeah, well, I loved the Minutemen, you know, a lot. You know, I loved you guys a lot, and you're playing so much, you know. And when Double Nickels came out, I was just like leveled. I listened to it just over and over and over and over again.
Norwood
was great, and there were other really good bands. You know band I used to like was the Suburban Lawns.
I think his name is Bill.
Yeah, Billy. Yeah, and there was this band that I really loved who didn't have a bass player called Neighbors Voices.
They were
French guys, and they were like it was real like arty, trippy, wild, odd grooves, and I met those guys and defended
I think
them.
They played the left hand on the synthesizer.
Yeah,
that was the bass.
I became friends with those guys and that drummer Joel. Like we used to play together a lot.
My idea of that, because I come from a punk before hardcore.
Yeah.
It was wild. I mean, sometimes you would say non Led Zeppelin, but that was only in the to get enough nerve to try something. You know.
Right.
Music
totally
should be music. Whenever there's a cool and a party line. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. So any party line I go away from. Like, even, like, I used to play with those Fishbone guys.
Anarchy.
The what?
The slogan was Anarchy.
Yeah.
Look at all these narrow...
Yeah, well, you'd see, like, I remember, like, I'd go to the Starwood and I'd see some guy who was, like, the year before, like, we were on a backpacking trip and he was, like, had feathered hair and a Lacoste shirt and his favorite band was... Journey. Then I go to the Star and I see him, he's got an Anarchy shirt and his big boots and he's, like...
Yeah.
You know what? You change completely, you know.
But you have simple rules, like you only have to listen to the right bands. So you can see how that might work for
you. Oh, no, totally, too. And as time goes on, it's like, you know, I learned, you know, restraint is great. And, like, you know, restraint in, like, listening and stuff and, like, learning stuff. Sometimes you get really into certain things. And it's a great learning process,
things
you know.
Get very social. So, like, we'll let the people in that don't like the Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
That kind of haircut. And
see
how humans do this.
Yeah,
even
I get it.
A movement that was supposed to be about chaos and wild stuff.
Yeah, and I get it too. And like when I became like good friends with like the Denny Brothers and stuff, and like
the weirdo guys.
Yeah, the weirdos, and like I played with John and Dix a lot, and I love those guys because they're
from the old
they were like totally punk rock, but they didn't like for them they didn't care about any of that shit. They just wanted to make art, you know. And
I think they were kind of from art background, right?
Yeah, well,
they
grew up a kind of bohemian.
And they went to some art school.
I don't know if they went to art school.
None of them.
But they're definitely artists, like just creative guys. They're always painting and drawing.
Seems
and
like
sculpting.
The old scene had a lot of those people.
Yeah, they're really into like Captain Beefheart and stuff. And like, I think like when they didn't even know what they were playing was going to be called punk rock, they were just playing this like crazy shit that it was fun for them.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's what the old scene seemed like to me.
Yeah, and I could really relate.
You know what? They weren't as much teenagers. The hardcore was kind of younger people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I became like that scene, like the hardcore scene, like. There were things that I liked, things I didn't like, but I really kind of bonded more with like the artistic elements, like the Denny's and like Tomato De Plenty and KK and all those guys. Like I could relate to them more. Like it just they weren't like hung up in fitting into a bunch of rules. You know, they were just like into making art. You know, and
kind of blowing minds.
Yeah,
Tomato for sure.
Yeah,
very kind of provocative.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I gotta pee really bad. I'll be right back. Sorry, it takes me a second. Sometimes it comes on strong. Kids and stuff from Suburbia. The thing I got real like someone I got the GI record, and that record really changed my life. Like literally, that's probably the most pivotal record musically in my life. Even though I don't know if I can say that for sure, but it just changed the way. Not the way I play so much, but my idea of what music was. Because I loved that record so much, and I would just like lay there every night in the headphones, reading the lyric sheet. You know, the inner sleeve.
It tripped me out because that record was a mind blow because I had seen him play so many times. And it was kind of hard to know that that's what was going on.
Right.
He already sang in the mic and stuff.
Right, right.
They'd have 10 minutes between songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They got practicing for that. Actually, they really good gigs came right when they were doing that.
Right.
They practiced up. But when I heard the thing, it was a trip, man.
Yeah.
It was really like these. What I thought to myself is these guys made their own music. I could kind of tell by the gigs.
Right.
The album was like, wow.
That album, man, it's such a great album.
It was really a trip. And then I never saw them again the same.
Mm.
You know, I heard the No God the thing with Nikki B.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like that album. There's something about that album. All those songs just. Freight train.
One after the other, and like the lyrics are so poetic and exciting, and the music, the arrangements, the playing.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's like the feeling of it.
Yeah.
Like it changed.
It was a trip. Every time I saw them after I heard that album, it was much different.
Yeah.
But I really liked them before that in a way. And not as a joke. I really thought they were a band that.
Right.
You know, they were cats you could talk. Did you ever get to talk with them? I mean, they would.
Pat,
talk
I'm friends
to
with
them.
Pat. And, yeah.
No, but in those days.
No, no, I never.
I'm from Pedro. I didn't know any of these guys, but you could rap with them.
Right.
And I would, like, talk to him about, you know, if you guys just, like, put one song after the other, man, you could, like, get some momentum. You know, I didn't know that part of their thing was, like, to, like, fuck. Talk about fucking with old rock and roll. They were like against all the.
Right.
They had been to plenty of arena. In fact, I remember asking him his favorite band. He said it was Queen.
Right. Was Pat or Darby?
Pat.
Right.
I guess Darby liked them too and stuff.
Yeah.
I was just so naive. I didn't know how the punk thing was just so trippy and crazy against arena rock ideas. I liked it. I liked it.
It just seemed to me like. Perfect music, like that germ, that GI record.
Scene
just,
too, man. I was around people that Raymond with Coltrane, and just so many doors opened to me. It's hard to tell people because they saw it as such a narrow thing, or like that thing, that experience with the
Black Flag show. Yeah,
I saw that shit. I didn't dig that.
I didn't like that.
I
don't like that. Like,
no, I never.
Because I had short hair just because I liked short hair, but I could have had long hair easily. It could have been me, you know.
Bullshit.
Yeah, bullshit. But I just, like, I would listen to that record, and it just, like, the feeling of it was so powerful with, like, this, you know, punk rock music, you know? And it just, and it, like, up until that point, I had put all of my, well, not to say all of it, but most of my excitement in music was the quality of the musicianship. For what I saw, I was like, well, these guys really play well together, they can play really well, they have interesting ideas. And all that stuff was there, but in this real kind of simple way, you know what I mean? But it was just so powerful. It floored me as much as like when I listened to Louis Armstrong when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
That same way. And I was just like...
Emotional impact.
Yeah, just man, just all of a sudden I had this thing, it doesn't matter what I play. If I play it with every fucking fiber of my being, It's going to mean something important, because that's who I am, and that's my nervous system, my soul, my psyche, whatever it is. It's going to mean something, and after that, it was just like I just felt like I couldn't fail. No matter what I do, I'm going to put all my heart into it, and it's going to be good. Like I just felt like I'm going to do the Chili Peppers, and I had that started with Chili Peppers, and had that attitude. I just didn't give a fuck. Right. You know, before that, I cared so much. I wanted to be good. I wanted to make. We gotta, you know, it's all gotta be perfect. And that, then I just said it freed me completely from all these constraints of having to live up to something.
Change your idea of it.
Yeah, and just
even
played,
though you had been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
From the school band and everything.
Yeah.
Maybe made more personal for you.
It made it more personal. It made me feel like. It wasn't like some magic trick of having to be famous or having to be some genius musician or having to be anything. I just had to be myself. And myself, like the germs taught me that just being myself and doing what I do was as valuable as anything else, and that's what I'm going to be.
Do you see music going someplace, or does it seem to come in like cycles? Like you just checked out a new music on another continent.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff very traditional and stuff. So what's new is you hearing it.
Yeah.
And so, maybe rediscovery is a big part of it. Maybe music isn't just moving in some like.
Yeah, no, it's discovering things and being touched by things, no matter what it is. Like
and
going.
It came from a long time.
Yeah, like going to Ethiopia, like those three ladies that were the first thing, you know, like they're playing this music. It's like 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
Old, ancient Ethiopian stuff. That's where the first people come from. Lucy, you know, that they found the oldest bones there.
Right, Lucy.
You know, and. It's just that feeling of hearing something, like when I saw those three ladies sing, it was like no distractions. Like, you know, like as a musician, I don't know if you think about it like this, but for me, like when I'm playing gigs or doing anything when I'm playing, it's always like the thing that I'm wrestling with, the thing that I'm reaching for is that place of no mind. You know what I mean? Of like no thought, no thinking, what am I going to play next? Nothing, just being a vehicle for this thing to fly through me.
I have the fear of the choke.
Right. Well, you know.
They call it red light fever, especially like when you know you're being recorded.
Oh, right.
If you could just get that out of your mind, you play so much better.
Well, that's the thing, is because you're thinking about like all the fear and the thoughts is like, what is the end product going to be? Yeah. What are the means to the end? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, what is it? You're always playing to get something.
Yeah.
To get a good recording or to do a good gig or to gain something in some way to be proud of this thing that you created. Instead, like I saw these ladies. He didn't give a shit about anything.
Yeah.
And that's just how it is for them. Like, all those distractions and all those things that I'm always wrestling with didn't exist for them.
Yeah.
Because they're just playing this music because they love it, because it's what they grew up with and it's what they do.
Yeah.
And they got together and it was so relaxed and so beautiful, so pure, man. You know, and like, and that's like, for me, like seeing that, and that's just this, you know, 1,000-year-old music, that's inspiring because that's what I'm reaching for, you know. And that's like, for me, like the thing that you know, like maybe like the germs, you know, at their best. They're just playing their shit, being their friends and playing what they played. And that's like, you know, when you're great, that's what it is. And I know, like, you know, like for the Chili Peppers, when we're at our best, happens once in a while, it's that, you know, we're jamming or improvising or playing a song or whatever, but there's no goal. We're not trying to entertain anyone. We're not trying to do anything, but we are entertaining them by just touching, like, the divine source of where it comes from, because that's what that is.
Yeah.
When you get all those distractions out of the way, you're just
right.
You know, you're just, it's like breathing, you know.
The more it's closer to the nature of it.
Yeah.
Instead of ideas.
Yeah.
But ideas are important, right?
Oh, of course,
composing.
Of course, and you react against things that you hear and see, and you want to like take something and move it and make it your own, and you know.
I can see that. I a lot of times it's fear of choking.
Yeah.
Cannot get over that shit.
Yeah. I don't
don't know why I hung up on that shit, because it actually makes you choke.
Yeah, oh, totally. I get that sometimes, you know. I get that for sure. Or I just get, you know, I get self-conscious or, you know.
That's what it is, self-conscious.
Yeah, they don't like playing with me, so when I'm jamming, whether I'm not doing good or, you know.
I just can't get it out.
You know, it was cool, like, or, you know, last year I played with Ornette. I don't know if I told you I was playing with Ornette.
Yeah, in England. Right?
Yeah, and he, man, I was so scared for months. Like, I knew, like, 2 months before I was going to do it, and I was terrified. I practiced all day long. He sent me a CD on this. All I did was work. And I got there, and it was like, he didn't give a shit about anything. Like, he's so open. He was just like, be free, make your sound. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't care about anything. You know, and it was like, that was a real lesson too, you know. Not that the practice wasn't good, but like the fear and the worrying about the result of it. You know what I mean?
Because
he'll just play anything. He doesn't care.
I know. But you got so much respect for the man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I want to like, hey, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience to play with my heroes, you know.
Right.
You know. But,
like,
yeah, no, totally. He was just like, oh, don't, you know, do whatever, don't worry about it. You know? Yeah.
That but was a great lesson.
It really was a great lesson, you know? I mean, yeah.
And how old?
He's old.
Late 70s? Early
yeah,
80s?
I think like late 70s. And playing great and dresses real sharp.
Yeah,
and
I kind of loud.
Yeah. Well, no, not sufficient. It's just sharp. Not always loud. I think in the 80s he went for those really... Was that in the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought when I dug it...
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
not
but
for a while. It was his need. I had a big respect. And he carries himself without a big front ego.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was very impressed.
Yeah, he said to me, he was saying to me, like, why would you ever want to play the same music over and over? He goes, the only reason is money and pussy. That's what he told me. This is Sornette's quote.
He was trying something, putting out his own record or something. Yeah.
Hmm.
He, you know, Caravan of Dreams and stuff, when he started in Fort Worth, he was...
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a self-motivated cat. He really took some chances. Have you read the Miles autobiography he talks about Ornette?
I haven't. I can't remember that part.
It's Belidge.
Miles didn't like him?
Like Tony was the young man. He knew what
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Tony's bringing Miles up. Ornette.
Yeah. He didn't like him.
Aren't you sure? He got on a lot of those, quote, free guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I think they had their effect on Miles.
For
he
sure.
He started, getting in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of my musical journey, like...
Yeah.
It's always been, like I talk about, like, not towing a line with punk rock or with anything ever. Like, for me, like, the thing that I've always tried to stay true to is just doing what I like and playing what I like. And I've been really lucky to be able to make a good living doing it and just have to be a musician, and it's what I always wanted to be, and... I think that everybody has musical talent. I think anyone who wants to be a musician can be a musician. I really do.
Oh, yeah, the school.
Yeah, so I was saying before, like, no, every
what
kid...
What did you first think of this school?
Oh, the idea was to start the school?
Yeah.
I first thought of it... I can't remember what... Like, first I thought... Because I have a friend who's a music teacher, and my friend Keith Barry, and I'd thought about, like, I just... Really just kind of for him that he... It'd be nice for him to have a good place to teach, you know? Because he's... Not that he didn't, he taught in a school down in, I think, like, Montclair, one of those places, Claremont or something. But he, But a couple of things happened. I was at a basketball... On tour, I went to see a Knicks game in New York, and I'm sitting next to this woman, and she starts telling me she's the music teacher at Fairfax High School in Los Angeles.
Huh.
You know, my alma mater.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we're just sitting watching the Knicks game, you know, and I was like, whoa, really? You know, I went to Fairfax, and da-da-da-da, and she's like, yeah, I know who you are. She goes, I'd be really great if you could come down and speak to the kids one day about a music, you know, about a career in music. And it's like, I was like, great, no problem. So when I went to Fairfax High, they had, you know, big orchestra, a marching band, a jazz band. They put on big musical productions. It was great. Like, and, you know, and it was such a fun thing for me. And like I said before, it was really like the thing I had to hold on to.
Right.
A discipline, friends, social world, everything, you know. And so she says, come down. And I go down there, and it's like, I go to Fairfax High, and it's an empty shell. The music department, when I went there, yeah, well, when I graduated in 1980, they passed Proposition 13, Reaganomics, and they cut out all the funding for the arts programs, Proposition 13. And I went in there, and where it used to be, when I went there, you could take any instrument you wanted. I want to play the clarinet. No, the violin. I want to play the clarinet and violin. Whatever you wanted, they'd give you an instrument and teach you how to play it, and you play it in a group. I mean, what amazing. You know, what it should be. You know, and I went there, and it was all gone. all the instruments were gone. The music department, the rooms were empty. They had a volunteer teacher, like a couple of acoustic guitars, fucked up acoustic guitars, and some kids who were wanting to know.
Program was gutted.
Gutted. It was gone. And it was really, like, heartbreaking to me. Because that place that I remember being so alive and music coming out of every room, you know, it was like nothing there. And it was really, you know, and I played for the kids. I went down there with Willie Waldman and Perkins, and we played and, you know, talked to the kids and stuff. And the kids were all excited that Willie played with Snoop. It was a big hit of the day. But after that, we, that really got it in my head. I should start a music school. I really should do this because, you know, these kids have an opportunity.
At the public school.
And that really in my head. I remember the final straw was about a year after that, I went to, I was kind of depressed about something, so I went down to Mexico, and I got this book by Horace Tapscott.
Yeah.
And
he
wrote this book called Songs of the Unsung, and it's his biography. And it's
so the Watts Festival.
And it was a really great book, and it talks about like how he started off his jazz career, and he was doing really well. He was like touring, playing with different people, getting signed, making his own records. But he felt really drawn to make a community center and a school for kids in L.A. And he started this music school in Los Angeles in South Central. And Billy Higgins got involved. I'm spacing on the name of the place right now, but he started this music school. They did gigs. They started orchestra. Kids, they had formed an orchestra. When the kids got good enough, they joined the orchestra. They did gigs at Limerick Park, World Stage.
Yeah.
And it went on for years and years, and he really believed in it. And it wasn't just his place wasn't just a music place; it was also dance, and poetry, cultural center. But it was a place where kids could go and learn music. And I was like, "That's it, you know. If I don't do this, I had this idea. I'm doing it." And I went home right away, and I just was like, called my friend Tree, got Pete Weiss help me. I was like, "Let's get a place. I'm paying for it. Get a place. We build it. We make it a music school. We hire the teachers. We do it. I'm doing it no matter what."
It's the youngest student.
The youngest, well, my daughter's taking violin, she's 4.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oldest student?
There's old people in there, like old.
Wow.
Yeah, senior citizens.
So it's not just kids?
It's for anyone.
Okay.
Yeah, it's mostly, I'd say.
How many students? 700?
There's 700 going in there each week. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and we use, like, there's a magnet school called Camino Nuevo nearby that we use for group classes because we don't have a big space for our group classes. And in exchange, we like our teachers teach their school, and then we use the Barnsdall Theater. Let's just use their theater for recitals, and it's just.
So what about the teacher thing? Is that hard?
Well,
the teacher.
To be one or to get them.
No, for you, like.
Oh well, it's been like when I've talked.
You started with that cat. The Claremont guy, right?
Yeah. He's the dean, and he's still the dean of the school.
He's the dean, yeah.
And he had been like teaching music for a long time, and so he knew a lot of teachers and stuff to start with. And as time has gone by, you know, we kind of fleshed him out and got a choice group of teachers, you know. Teaching, it's great, man. I've only done it like I did 2 6-month stretches because I didn't want to. We don't have to have time to really do it, you know, because we don't want teachers that are going to teach and then disappear.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's really important for continuity with the kids.
Right.
But is really good, you know, like having a relationship with the kid.
You picking teachers, is that kind of tough?
Oh, well, I he does the picking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
he's kind of a hard ass about it.
But it's probably not just technical, it's some kind of people skills. Huh?
It is for sure. It is for sure.
It's not about just reading rules and
Different. There's different types of teachers. Yeah. Some are more like real strict and academic. Some are more like Lonnie Marshall, you know, he's a bass teacher there, and he's more kind of like learning to play along to records and stuff like that. Teachers have different things. We try to keep it as academic as we can.
Sure.
Because we don't want...
It's still about reaching the kid.
Yeah, reaching the kid. It's about reaching the kid, and different teachers have different ways, but we definitely want our school to be about technique and fundamentals and learning how to play an instrument, not at all about aesthetic. Like, if you want to be a rock musician, be a rock musician. If you want to be a classical musician, whatever you want to do, go do it.
Music's music.
Music's music, but we're teaching... You know, academics and fundamentals and technique and reading music and theory and like that. So we just don't want to be about, like, sometimes people get that thing, oh, flea school, it's going to be like rock star camp or something. And, you know, and it's like nothing to do with any of that. We're, you know, and, yeah, it's just been great, you know, and it's like, we're coming up on our 10th year and it's just really flourishing, you know. It's like, it's the thing, like having a good idea and going and doing it, and like it really was a lesson for me. You can do stuff, you know, like actually started it and did it, and here we are 10 years
using
later.
Using that same method. To yeah. Get back, you saw bad situation.
Yeah, no, I just saw, yeah. Down. Yeah, and was inspired by people doing something really great, like what Horace Tapscott
did. You know
what,
it was good enough for me, and I don't need it. No, yeah. It's like, no, there's still debt, there's still need.
Yeah. He's but great. Yeah, no, totally, and you know, I feel like the arts, you know, like actually, Keith or Tree, my friend, I call him Tree.
Yeah.
He came up with this the kind of his like little slogan, which was like, you know, you talk about the three R's in school, that where he proposes the three A's, which are arts, academics, and athletics, all being of equal value,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's really like not having arts in school, it's so fucked up, man. It's like child abuse. It's just like, it's so important, you know? You're going to have a bunch of, like, kids grow up as ignoramuses with no...
And the music only used to sell a candy bar or...
Yeah, music just to sell, and this is stuff that gets forced down their throat on the radio and what's cool and American Idol and all this, like, corporate bullshit.
Thanks for teaching us about Ethiopia. So
yeah, that was yeah, righteous.
Okay?
Yeah.
And these ideas are great. And I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be
here. Great having you.
Yeah.
Brother Matt, thank you.
Cool.
Aiden and Abed, always. It's February 21st, 2010, Wapping Pedro Show. Thank you again, Flea.
Thank you.
Keep your powder dry.